Howdy, y'all. You're listening to The Managing Up Show, a podcast about leading and managing in the world of technology. I'm your host, Nick Means, and with me this week are Travis Swicegood.
Howdy.
And Brandon Hayes.
Hello. So this week, we actually have changed our idea for what we want to talk about several times, but I think we kind of landed at a place where we want to talk about what you do when you don't have all the context necessary to lead a team like you might normally. And that can manifest in a lot of different ways. One of the things that we talked about was, what do you do when you have some information maybe that you can't share with your whole team? But more importantly, or more interestingly, or more commonly, what do you do when you only have just kind of the ragged edge of some context around something that you know is operating in some shadowy future for your team? And you can't even put the entire picture together. You only have a little bit of it. And it means that you're dealing in a time of uncertainty. And essentially, like, this sounds too broad, but there, I think anybody who's done this for a little bit can relate very deeply to the idea that you can have some context about something that is going to happen, but there is some sort of uncertainty about some kind of change that might be coming your way. You may know something about the change for sure is going to happen. If you're at a startup, it could be that there's a potential pivot on the horizon. If you're at a larger company, it could be an organizational change. And so managing through times of change is definitely an interesting topic, but a lot of times you actually don't know what the change is. And you start seeing some weird things happen around your teams. You can start to see work start slowing down and responsibilities dial down. And a lot of times that comes from just a period of some kind of uncertainty. And so I wanted to open that up and ask you if you've ever experienced that. And if you do, and you want to be able to answer the questions of your team and lead them and find something meaningful to orient the team toward, but you actually don't have your hands on the whole context. So first, have you experienced that? And second, what do you do if you do?
I mean, I think one of the ways, it seems like this is a more common situation to encounter in larger engineering teams. The bigger a team you're part of, the more often you're going to see stuff like this. Sometimes it's in the form of a reorg that you find out about weeks before you're allowed to share any information about. Sometimes it's when your boss starts hinting around about things and can't tell you the full thing because, I mean, in an acquisition type situation, typically they will be legally precluded from telling you things until they have been released to tell you. So sometimes you'll start getting some hints that there might be a thing coming that you might want to be prepared for, and it might be shaped like this, but not really enough specificity to give you any concrete actions to take. And that's one of the challenges, is how do you get from that sort of cloudy, fuzzy, this thing is coming sense of impending doom to getting your team pointed the right direction to be ready when it finally lands?
So Travis, before the call, you were actually talking about one strategy that I kind of like and I thought was kind of baller actually, which is put yourself in a position to get as much of that context as you can, and put yourself in a position to, because the more you have, the better decisions you can likely make. Like beyond any sort of legally precluded things that you can't do, often it's just people may not know that you would do something useful with that information. You mentioned like how to kind of like, I don't remember what you said, but I thought it was really good, where you can kind of put yourself in a position where people want to entrust you with that.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically tracing the last half decade or so of my career has been trying to get into positions where I'm able to help make some of those decisions and help provide that context to the rest of the executive team. I think having a really good relationship with your boss and making sure that they view you as an ally that can help them, because nobody wants to be in a situation where they feel like their team is caught flat-footed. So making sure that you've really built up that relationship and that you're going to get drawn into that inner circle as soon as possible. That's really what it kind of boils down to in a lot of situations, especially when you're going down the acquisition or merger route. It's just a matter of who's on the inside of the circle and who's on the outside at any given time. And mostly that's legal constraints. They want to keep those as small as possible just to make sure that something doesn't happen that ends up costing a lot of time and money and heartache. So that's definitely one thing that you can focus on there.
But at a certain point, like I've definitely been in those positions where I've felt like somebody's come to me, or I've heard somebody come to me and they've said, okay, I'm not supposed to tell you X, but I'm going to hint at some things that are going to lead you to the ability to conclude that something like X might happen. And it narrows it down. And so you're like, have this like weird, really weird, spotty context. And you have this period of uncertainty and you look at your team, and your team is looking to you to help provide context around, essentially like a North Star. Mm-hmm. I think that's a part of what managers do. I know that that's not necessarily true for everybody's definition, but for me, I value that. And so I'm wondering, what do you do with your team? What do you do when you no longer can reliably point to the North Star that the organization says, here's your KPI, here's your marching orders, here's what we expect out of this team, here's what we want you to deliver and win, and something causes you to not have necessarily total faith in that, or you might not have it, or it gets taken away from you, and you know that's not a thing, but you can't share that with the team yet. Like, how do you help a team continue to move forward and operate and be productive in those moments?
So if you feel like you've lost 100% confidence in the direction you thought you were heading, I would challenge you to think about what you're using as your North Star for what the team should be delivering. And what I mean by that is a lot of managers, a lot of teams, a lot of companies, frankly, get caught up in the idea of solving for a particular problem and not how they go about solving for that particular problem. So this is a situation where trusting that process, whether that's a very solid scrum process with all of the ceremonies, whether it's a waterfall process with beautiful 100-page RFPs, or some very lightweight process, but how you go about making and delivering value, if you can focus in on that, I think that's one way to help try to find some stability. Because if your goal is to deliver a quality product, what you have today is probably not the best version of what you could deliver. But you have something right now that you have delivered. And if you can iterate on that and focus your energy on refining that, I think that can be a valuable way to help fill in some of those gaps where you're like, well, I thought I knew we built X and our team, we did this thing. It can be extremely disorienting to have that taken away from you, to say, oh, but we are a communication team. Oh, but we are the infrastructure team. When for whatever reason that's called into question, that can be disorienting. But if the infrastructure or the communication or whatever your particular domain happens to be, when that's the outcome of the things that you do, you can focus on the things that you do and continue to refine what you already have in a way that can give you a little bit of solace in that like really uncomfortable kind of in-between space.
So one strategy I've seen work pretty well along those lines is often when you get these hints of information that change is coming, it comes with a fairly dramatic shift in focus for your team. So often that's what's looming on the horizon, that you're going to have to make a right turn on the things that you're focused on. So one of the strategies that I've employed when faced with a situation is trying to work on the operability of the system we're focused on right now. Because if you know your attention's about to be changed and you're about to have to focus on something different, you're about to have to pull the team onto something else, one of the things that you want to do is to take your current work and put it in a good, for lack of a better term, long-term storage kind of state where it's going to take care of itself and you're not going to have to do a lot of work to it while you focus on the new thing.
Yeah, I think everybody says they want to do that or should do that while you're building the product itself. That's just not how things get prioritized.
No, it never is.
Because there's always an opportunity to take advantage of. There's a feature that will unlock a deal for a customer, or you know, there's some reason that adding to the thing is more important than stabilizing the thing and making it more self-sufficient. And you just eat the cost of doing that, of maintaining the thing, because you can kind of bake it into the cost of improving the thing. But when those, you know, the cost curve flattens, And it's like we're dramatically decreasing the amount of money and time and energy we're going to spend improving this thing. Suddenly you don't have that cover fire for stabilizing the product as you go along. So that's a really good point. Giving the team a reason to say, what would we do to make this thing manage itself, to reduce the cost of ownership of this thing, is a really good question that I think, like I said, everybody kind of deludes themselves into thinking we're going to be able to ask ourselves that question along the way. That's a really good point. And I want to talk about a couple more tactical things. I think there's a little bit more to explore here as well about what you do when your normal work kind of evaporates and there is a period of uncertainty. And I've experienced this at multiple jobs in the past, particularly at startups. During pivot periods, pivots are very difficult. And I don't know if this is unique to the couple of startups that I'd worked at, but during a pivot, teammates want to know like what they can do that would be useful and productive. And the business is saying, we don't know. And what I have seen that does not work, speaking to Travis's point about what not to do, one thing that doesn't work that I have tried to do in the past is like make something up. That's such a dangerous move and be like, okay, well, here's going to be our North Star. We're going to go do this while we wait for the business to make up its mind. And I'll you know, send the team on some mission. And you know what we generated was a ton of technical debt. Like, hey, let's build our infrastructure up really well. Let's have like a really great Kubernetes platform and a really great this and invent our own React framework and do all these things while we wait for the business to come back to us and say, okay, we're ready. And then when they come to us, we will have done all the pre-work and we can just get to the regular work. And that's not how good software gets made. You don't like set up six weeks to 6 months of tooling and then think you're going to like write your first line of code in your project and everything's going to be like super, like you basically made it the nicest house that code ever lived in. It just doesn't really work like that. You kind of have to build the house for it as you go along, because otherwise you're going to build it to the wrong spec. And so we wound up having to unwind all of the technical sort of flights of fancy that we had been taking during that downtime. And I don't actually know in those moments what to do when you're sort of waiting for the business to come tell you, okay, here's our new marching orders. Because it will happen eventually. You know, this is seasonal. the business is going to come back to you at some point and say, oh, by the way, it's time for you to start delivering value again. But I don't know what to do with that time. I feel like, Travis, I feel like you know the answer to this, and I'm just waiting for you to tell it to me.
No pressure, right? In my mind, you're talking about building frameworks and things like that. Like, the best frameworks are always the ones that are built in retrospect. Like, you extract that out of something that's actually working, not try to anticipate what's going to happen. And I think that's true for all software. But that's a challenge when you're trying to just fill some time. I think you're so close to the correct or one of the many correct possibilities here. When you're talking about like focusing on tooling and infrastructure, like what are the things today? So to come back to Nick's point from earlier, what are the things right now that you could do that were like, you know what, if we had deployed to staging on Merge today, like I don't need a new deployment infrastructure, but what's standing between me and that so that we don't have to have somebody actually do a deploy once a day so that staging is kept up to date. So that's taking something, an existing problem that you have, that's not necessarily a problem that your users face in most likelihood, but it's something that your developers face. Like that's a problem that you can start to think about how you could solve, that solves an existing problem you have today that makes your developers a little bit more efficient and gain some experience. So when you get to that point that you've got to go build out that new whiz-bang Kubernetes deploy with all of your custom resource definitions, you might have a little bit more expertise in that area. But trying to guess what all that's going to look like ahead of time, that comes into like taking a guess. And it's an educated guess, very possibly. Like you might have some idea of where you're headed, but trying to guess on what you should develop instead of stopping looking at where you're at, I think that's where you can find yourself getting yourself into trouble and your entire team and spending those cycles that you're like, well, that was fun educational experience, but we don't really have anything that we can use from there.
So do you usually wind up building things where you throw the code away when the rubber starts hitting the road again? Or do you try to build stuff that you think is going to persist through that time period? Because like in those moments, like I've seen entire code bases just dumped in the garbage because a pivot means you're not in the same business anymore. You're not selling the same product.
Yeah, but it really depends. So, I mean, that's kind of a knowing the company you're in. Is a pivot going to be, all right, we're going to quit new feature development on this product and just let it continue to make some money in the interim? Or is it, yeah, we don't do that anymore. Like we're now no longer a photo sharing company. We are, we do check-ins. Like that's the Gowalla pivot here in Austin years ago. They were going to be an Instagram-like site. Foursquare catches all of this attention and press, and they had some things that were kind of like Foursquare. And it's like, well, I guess we're a location company. Like those are two totally different companies with two totally different things. But are you an HR company that was doing HRIS stuff and now you do surveys because you had a really cool survey tool inside that? That's almost like the soft pivot versus the like, no, we're just a different company today.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's sort of like when you work in a bigger company and your focus changes dramatically. It's like if you ever had any customers that you want to keep on the prior thing that you were building, then you probably have to maintain that. And so Nick's suggestion of finding a way to make that cheaper and easier to maintain is a good goal while you're waiting to hear, okay, I mean, there are going to be periods like that where you're waiting to hear what the business is hoping to accomplish.
So of the three of us, Nick, I feel like you're the one who works at the largest of the companies. I am definitely at the smallest of the companies, with my company being smaller than either of your teams. But I feel like with my handful of years of experience at larger companies, and it is definitely handful compared to the rest of my time, I would expect to be in situations where I'm not operating with full visibility, or I'm operating in very ambiguous circumstances if I was at a larger company. Given the larger companies that I've worked at, maybe I've just like hit the lottery and hit all of them at times of massive upheaval and change. But I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some of the strategies that you've had where you felt that you've been in a very ambiguous situation and had to guide a team where you weren't actually sure where you were guiding them, just over there.
I mean, yeah, I think you're right. I think the larger the company, the more pathways information has to flow through that company. And that inevitably means there's more places for that information to stop and more places where that information needs to stop, because there are decisions that need to be made before it can be shared further in the organization. So for me, one of the strategies that I employ is I make a lot of friends and I spend a lot of time talking to people that aren't in my direct portion of the organization, just to kind of get a feel for the weather, just to know which way the winds are blowing and where people think things are going. I've picked up a lot of important information from talking to people that are very far from the part of the organization that I exist in. So in a large organization, that's one of the big keys, is to make sure that you're building your network internally to the organization so that you know what's going on beyond just the things that your manager is allowed to tell you. The other thing is build a reputation of integrity, so that when people share something with you that they may be on the edge of if they should or shouldn't share, that they know it's not going anywhere. Because that's one of the things that you can do that will get you earlier access to information, because the people that have the information know they can trust you with it and that you will get your organization pointed in the right direction without divulging anything that you shouldn't divulge.
I think that the networking piece is unbelievably important and so easily underrated, especially internally. And I mean, I feel like I'm speaking from some experience here. It's so easy to get caught up with what's right in front of you. And I think every developer knows this. You get caught up with what's right in front of you and you miss the bigger picture. And when you're thinking about your job as a manager, it's just as easy to go down that exact same path. I'm so caught up with the thing that we are delivering right now, the deliverable that's immediately in front of me. You get caught up in that urgent loop and forget the bigger picture that's around you. So that's a great call out.
Yeah, I really like that. And that speaks to me pretty deeply, because in those moments, if you're on a team that has lost visibility to what they thought was their North Star, and they go, hey, we were trending toward this thing and you were taking us there, you're the fearless leader, you're supposed to know what's going on. Part of the strategy can be to know more about what's going on in that space. But the further you can zoom out, the better off you are. And so what you're talking about by meeting other people in your organization is, I had this like mental picture of, you know, if you're standing on one leg, you're really wobbly. But if you can establish more points of contact, you can be more and more stable. And the further out those are, the more stable you are. And the real place is, unless you're at a very sick company, the real place is with your customers. If you know what your customers and potential customers are asking of you and what you do for them and what the value of the company is to those customers, then you actually understand you now are on solid ground. And it can feel very hard to know which way is up. Because a lot of times when you're working, like you were just saying, Travis, that it can kind of feel like you're in a snow globe and you get all shaken up and you can't really see through the blizzard. And you can be all flipped upside down and you have no idea which way gravity is even pulling you. And all of a sudden, if you reconnect to those things that you know to be true, and something occurred to me when you were talking earlier is, I know why this company exists. I know what this company is about. I know the company way. You know, like there is a set of values that this company has, whatever they say their values are, they actually have some. And if you know what those are, it's usually attached somehow to what's special about the relationship between the company and their customers and the way the company interacts internally. And if you have friends and a network inside the organization, and if you have visibility into what the value the company provides to customers, you have really stable footing to be able to respond to times of uncertainty and change. And so when somebody comes at you to change things around and throws everything upside down in a tizzy, it's very easy to actually reorient, because you go, hey, as you know, team, our mission as a company is to do XYZ for these people. Well, yesterday that looked like this, and in the near future, it's going to look more like this. But the mission doesn't change. The purpose doesn't change. The North Star is actually more like well-established. And I've found that to be really useful and important because I myself do have a tendency to get lost in the details, to really zoom in and be like, okay, we're going here. Let's get this thing done. I'm pretty goal-oriented. I want to know what the KPIs are. We can hit them. But I've had entire KPI systems thrown out. And then what do you do? Like, oh, my beautiful KPIs. Oh no, my OKRs are our toast. You need to be able to be resilient to that.
It's funny you mentioned OKRs because that's one of the stories that gets brought up a ton when you're talking about companies changing is Intel against Motorola in the early 80s. And the objective remained the same. They added one new one. It was like stop Motorola. But the key results across the entire company changed overnight. And they're like, oh, okay, so like but the main objective was to be the best of what they were in their market and then kill Motorola if we can, was the secondary one.
If by chance you should encounter a Motorola along your travels.
But at the end of the day, that was the OKRs were what they were able to lean on because you didn't have people having to hit a certain number of units sold or a certain number of units demoed or things like that, which would have gotten in the way because it's a lot easier to game those KPIs, or as the theory goes, it's a lot easier to game that than it is to say, well, our main objective, which maybe has changed, but probably is still similar, but now we're measuring that. We're measuring, are we the best in the game by, did we beat Motorola in every deal that we went head to head on versus how many deals did we win? So that kind of comes back to, again, thinking about the way you measure yourself and understand how well you are existing in the world, making sure that that's flexible and can change. And I think you're dead on in the way you're describing this of like, how can you understand the values of the company? And I think in this sense, the way you're using values and the way I would use objectives of the company are almost interchangeable. And if your objectives are so tactically focused that they're subject to the whim of the market, maybe they're not really objectives and you have some key results as objectives.
I think one thing I want to circle back to is the second point that I made around folks feeling comfortable sharing with you. I want to clarify that because I don't want it to sound like I'm trying to get you in positions to get people to tell you things that you're not supposed to know. It's more about maturity and ability to handle information. You know, one of the things that determines the access to information you get in a larger company is what you can hear without freaking out.
Absolutely.
That's so true.
And the more consistently you display maturity when you hear that information and you take the time to understand exactly what's being shared with you and you ask intelligent questions and you gather the context that you need to help your team deal with what might be a shocking situation that's emerging, the earlier you'll get access to that information and the more time you'll have to digest it before you have to lead your team through it.
So no going office panda when somebody tells you something is crazy. If you start breaking keyboards... That might be the last time you hear about something before anybody else. Also, watch for new keyboards to get delivered to your desk. That's a dead giveaway. Things are about to change. Here's your keyboard. Yeah, no, I think that's a great clarification. I really do. There's a sense, and I think a lot of developers actually think this way. They view networking as something that marketing folks do or sales guys do. Like, that's just not a thing that a developer does. I don't have time with that. Dealing with people. I have known some amazingly talented developers who I feel like I just channeled in that comment. And they view that idea of networking as, was it Viserys, the whisperer or the spider in Game of Thrones, as the person who's behind the scenes trying to understand what's going on. So I think developers, engineering type folk, I think a lot of people who are drawn to management probably don't view it that way, but it's very tempting to fall into those old habits, especially when you're grasping for the familiar. You're trying to find the things that you feel comfortable with us if you're moving into a role like this for the first time. And you kind of discount that networking as I'm trying to get my little birdies in all of the networks so I understand what's going on. That's definitely not what networking is.
Well, there's a couple components of this. And one of those is, you know, I will call back to Nick's really fantastic talk about this, about the Eiffel Tower, where he talks about this specifically, that networking isn't a narcissistic pursuit of building relationships to advance your own goals. It is about making friends and building relationships. And you can do that authentically and in a way that is oriented toward helping other people. And you'll find that you have an easier time getting the things you want done because you're oriented toward what we want done. It's just like there's an authentic and humane way to do that that I think is exploited often enough by people who operate selfishly that it leaves a bad taste in people's mouths because they have seen it or have felt it taken advantage of by people who do that disingenuously or in bad faith. But there is you learn that you must develop that skill and operate in good faith if you want to do that sustainably. And there's lots of benefit, not just to be had, but then to be sort of shared with other people if you're willing to do that. So that's part one. The other part that Nick brought up that I want to touch on is this idea that the word that came to mind when you were talking about it was equanimity, which is this, I learned it through the course of like mindfulness practice, which is like this idea of calmness and composure, even if there's like a shitstorm happening around you. And it's like, yeah, there's a shitstorm, but you can walk through it and it's not going to kill you.
What meditation apps are you listening to?
It's not a popular one.
No, I want to sign up for it. Yeah. All right. We're going to practice on not reacting to the shitstorm that is happening.
So you might find yourself in a difficult situation, but the ability to approach that with an evenness, which right now is really hard. As we record this, the entire world is still, you know, in the grip of this pandemic. And I'm finding my access to my own mental calmness and composure to be more difficult to access than normal. And so the work, interestingly, as a manager, the personal work you do to achieve equanimity in your own self is exactly the key that you need to bring that kind of resiliency to your team to persist through times of uncertainty and times of change and times of fear and provide that like spark of hope or that spark of vision that says, you know, hey, this time of uncertainty does exist. It is real. It's not fake. You're not imagining it, but it's also not forever. And on the other end of it, there's a version of this team that's better and stronger and has survived it and has done some work in between here and there that will still have mattered once we're through this. Like, I believe that very strongly, and I search for that. Like, what is that? And hopefully you've established that previously during the course of your work together with the team, where that pattern of behavior and that pattern of, for lack of a better word, leadership, of unifying a team around something that's bigger than just this quarterly objective allows you to sort of point at something beyond that, that people can kind of feel, even if you can't even describe it. But they read you. They read that sense that you have. So I've been the equanimous leader, and I've been the panicky, hurried, freaked out, worried leader. And people will read either one of those and respond accordingly.
Yeah, if you want to get a team to panic, all you got to do is panic yourself.
It's wild.
And on the other hand, if you want a team to remain calm, step one is you have to remain calm. Step two, you have to be calm enough to be a sink for some of what they're going to throw off in the process of dealing with the news.
That's true.
And that's one of the things that makes this role so difficult in times of change. And frankly, in times like right now, when we're all dealing with COVID-19, because part of the manager's job and part of what makes our roles so draining right now is helping our teams through some of that emotion as well. So something that we could talk about in this vein, and what to do when you know change is coming and you don't know exactly what to do with your team, is kind of the gross part of the job that managers oriented like us don't often think about, and that's delivering business value. We tend to be very focused on caring for our teams and coaching them and supporting them and providing what they need, but part of what our job is in times of uncertainty is to figure out some strategy in the interim that will still be valuable for the company that we're part of, even when we don't have concrete day-to-day information to operate on.
So I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because I actually really like refocusing. I actually don't think it's gross. I actually think it's really humane, because at its heart, a business relationship involves a transaction, and you ignore the transaction at your peril. And if you don't recognize that a transaction is occurring and that a person is expected to provide value, you're actually being disingenuous with that person. And I love the huggy part of this, you know, where it's like, hey, we're all friends and I want to be a good manager and listen to your problems. But the reality is, I'm also here to make sure that this transaction is equitable. So I'm actually advocating almost modally in both sides. And so during times of uncertainty, that part is actually really hard to get a hold of. And I sense, and the thing is, the reason it's so humane to recognize that is the people that work with you aren't stupid. They know that this is fundamentally at the base a transaction. And if they don't understand the value that they're providing in that transaction, 8 out of 10 people will be mentally, like, you will watch their mental stability decrease because they're like waiting for the other shoe to drop. I haven't provided any value in a while. Now, there are some people that are fine, just toying with things and building in their laboratory or whatever. And they're like, well, I don't know. As far as I know, everything's fine. I'm getting paid to do this. But I would say 7 or 8 out of 10 people that I've ever managed have some spider sense that they need to be providing value of some kind. And that part is really hard as a manager in those moments where the value proposition isn't super clear between the business and what your team is doing. And I actually become a little panicky in those moments.
I mean, I think you're right. That's a great pushback. A couple things that makes me think of. Number one, one of the things you can do as a manager in times when that value isn't apparent is find ways to turn that pressure down. Find ways to help people understand that is not what they have to be doing at this moment in time and help them get out of that mindset. And the other thing that I love that you brought up transactionality about is one of the things that you can do is get people to remember that it is a transaction and to take some of that downtime as time to get something back from the company, to focus on learning something new or to invest in their skills if there's not quite enough concrete work to fill the day.
I have an interesting story that kind of ties these two together in a really interesting way. I had a developer that I hired, kind of a fluke that I actually ended up hiring him. And it came from a startup. It was a standard startup. They had raised a fair amount of money, had a good idea, were able to execute it to varying degrees, and had gone through a lot of shifting. I mean, this developer had worked their way pretty high up in the organization during their time there. And when he joined my team, it was an R&D team, very, very loose charter on what they were going to be working on. But it was a whole new technology stack. Everything was new to him when he came in. And we had our weekly one-on-ones, and it probably took 6 weeks before he felt comfortable not showing up with something to ship. Because in the startup world that he had existed, where they had pivoted a couple of times over the few years that he was there, things were constantly shifting and changing. He had gotten so used to the, I have to be doing something of value, and I haven't shipped code in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks. I haven't shipped anything to production. How am I doing anything of value? And I'm like, okay, but look back at all these things that you've done in the interim to get yourself into a situation where you are able to deliver value. And he on that team, we as a unit delivered some really cool stuff over the course of our tenure at that company. But that initial experience was really rough for him because it was so disorienting to come down from such a high pressure, relatively early-ish stage startup where I have to understand the value because I've seen half the team get laid off. I understand what that's like when we pivot and there's no longer a place, so I want to make sure that I'm valuable. And then to come into an organization where it was like, no, it's totally cool that you get up to speed with the tech stack that we're working on. Like, go do that. And then once we actually zero in on what we're going to tackle, you're going to be ready for it. So that's a situation where somebody was too far to the what value am I delivering side of things that when they came into a situation that just happened the way they got hired, they were walking onto a team that was still probably about 2 months away from having its like really understanding what it was going to be because it was a very nebulous idea that we were forming this team around to begin with. He was completely disoriented by not having that North Star of what value am I delivering? Because he knew instinctively that it was a transaction and he was being paid to provide value and was so focused on the tangible that he lost track of the bigger picture of, wait, the value I'm doing is my ability to do something.
Yeah, and I like that. I like what both of you have described as sort of this exercise of reframing, of pulling back and saying, hey, you're really focused right now on providing value in the very small week to week. And a thing I've heard from my boss at my current place and something I've thought about and said many times, but I've not always been able to really say this authentically at places I've worked. And that is, this is a long-term relationship. we're making an investment in this work relationship with you, and we would really like this to last for years and years. We can't predict what the future holds, but we would like to invest in this relationship as if it were. And that's difficult to come by in startup world where work relationship is a pretty predictable 18-month cadence with people. But if you can break that cycle up a little bit and say, hey, I'm not interested, you know, I'm not interested in what this looks like if this is a 75-week engagement. If I knew we were only working together for 75 weeks, we would be talking about what you were doing week to week, because that's not very many of those. But what if we're working together for 5 years? What changes? What decisions do we change? And I've had people work with me who are freaking out because they haven't, you know, they haven't provided value in 2 or 3 days. They're just so wired for that. And honestly, they're experienced enough and have a breadth of experience that I don't think they'll ever shake that sense. And you just have to keep coaching them through that. Hey, you're doing fine. Mm-hmm. And the thing that helps me is to reframe a little bit and not just say, you can't just pat somebody on the head and it mm-hmm. goes away. You have to give them the thing that says, here's why it's mm-hmm. okay. Here's what we're currently doing. Here's where we're going. And here's what your contributions are out. Like one thing that you said, Travis, was helping somebody recognize their contributions above and beyond what the code output looks like. Because that's a very small way to look at what contribution looks like. And I find having an engineering ladder that's really well defined and offers like, here are the kinds of impact we expect a person at this level to have. Let's review this periodically. And when we look down here, like I keep track of a wins sheet with all the people I work with and say, okay, here are your wins. They're not all about things that you shipped. Their impact you had on our team and getting shout outs from other teams for being so helpful and making a difference in the lives of your coworkers and making a difference to our customers in these various ways. And they're not all attached to code. In fact, maybe the minority of them are code, directly code, and helping people recognize that value exchange is happening. And I really love, Nick, what you said about the idea that learning new things is a way you can add value. And that's a really great, kind of a dangerous thing, because I've done that with people where I've shifted them to learning and they never shift back into shipping because I wasn't able to find something for them.
I've never seen that.
Be careful
happen,
with that one ever. A little bit. Yeah, I've got more than one example. But I do think that learning how to grow in your job and learning how to get better at it is very reasonable, and being able to find the time for that and say, this is actually the value exchange here is bigger, and you actually have already provided a bunch of value. I can't remember if this was you, Travis, that said this a little bit ago, where it's like, hey, you've provided a bunch of value. It's okay to take a little bit of that transaction back off of the table at this point. I think that's really a nice broad way to look at it. And I think that would help an individual come to grips with it.
So a lot of what we've been talking about is we kind of like mulled over these ideas. We've narrowed it down to a very individually focused situation. How do we deal with a person that's feeling this? How do we make people feel this particular way? But it's tend to be focused on particular personality types, particular individuals. How do we take this and apply this at a more systemic level? Because at the end of the day, very few of us are managing one person. We're managing a collection of people, and it's the organization of those people that's the thing we're trying to help move to deliver that value that we've been talking about. That's the value that we deliver to the company. How can we organize everyone to operate as a unit in these situations of uncertainty where we may not necessarily know what the next quarter looks like, or maybe we don't know what the next 2 weeks are going to look like?
One thing I like you said there is, how do you get everybody to operate together as a unit? Because it is very common in those moments of uncertainty for people to retreat back into their caves. I think I've seen it happen every time, where the natural inclination is, okay, every person for themselves, go back to what you do well. You know this about code. You're really great at documentation. You're everybody just goes back to the thing they're comfortable with and feels like they can do something about in their sphere of individual control. And so you really do, first and foremost, have to have something that allows the team to continue operating like a team. Because uncertainty will take that away from you if you're not careful.
So would you do something like that by taking it and saying, like, normally there would be some sort of cross-pollinization that would happen with a team. So you have somebody that's the DevOps or SRE person on the team, and they're the person that handles getting things deployed, ensuring that everything's ready to deploy, and ensuring that all the metrics are in place and things like that. In a situation where you have a little bit of downtime or you're trying to fill in the gaps kind of and make sure you're doing something productive, do you use that time to say, all right, Bob, you're going to go teach Alice and Charlie how to do X, and spread that knowledge around or enhance the documentation. Like maybe they're not a docs person, but they're going to sit down with the person on the team that's really into writing and make sure that README is bulletproof.
I don't know, but I like that idea. I like the idea of also asking and saying, hey, what is it that if you had more time that you've mm-hmm. seen other people on this team do, if you had more time, you would learn how to do. But set these things up in a way that people don't retreat into their corners, to me, feels like the most important thing. The other thing you said that I liked a lot was the idea that objectives need to be able to withstand damn near a nuclear blast. That your objectives cannot get blown up because you had a change in strategy. Then it's not an objective. It's a, you know, it's a key result. And so I really like that idea that your top level objectives need to be resilient to that. And then you can roll back up. What I think a lot of people do and a lot of managers with less experience will be, well, I've tried, and they'll go like apply pressure up the chain to say, give us something to do, give us this, give us that. And a more experienced person would probably do something like, I know that one of the objectives of this company is this. Here are some resources we have on the team. Here are some things that we could be doing to advance those and ask for permission, essentially, and or assert that you know, it would be a good idea if you put this team to work in a certain direction. That's if you don't have anything else that, the learning period and the cross-training, or you don't know how long this period of uncertainty is going to be, which feels pretty relevant right now, that finding things and sourcing those and validating them against true company objectives, like the mission and purpose of the company, things that are really attached to it. If you don't know how long that's going to last, being able to sort of create some heat around that is actually probably pretty, it's good for the team. It's really good. It'll be a good experience for you. It's not going to look bad.
So the thing you talking about retreating to caves makes me think of, Brandon, is I'm not sure there's a management situation this doesn't apply to, but it's really key to do the work ahead of time to build psychological safety on your team so that you can have these conversations in the first place. Because if you don't have that baseline of rapport, you don't have that baseline of trust, it's really difficult to navigate these situations without everybody just freaking out and feeling afraid.
That's really true.
Yeah. And at this point, I feel like we've almost come full circle for how do you put yourself in a situation where you understand what's going on to how do you handle this? And at the end of the day, I feel like a good chunk of it comes to making sure that you have the trust of those around you in all directions. And like, if I had to boil down this entire conversation that we've had over the last almost an hour, I feel like that's the key way that you can focus on providing the most stable structure for your team and yourself is making sure that you have the trust of those around you so that when things change, you're not having to contend with that as well as trying to contend with the change. Like, try to limit the number of things you have to contend with at any one time.
Yeah. Well, to that end, actually, like one of the ways that I want to use the trust that I hopefully have built during that time with the individuals on the team is saying, trust me, there's reason to hope. And here's what hope looks like. Because it's easy to despair and become despondent in times of uncertainty because you don't know. And times of uncertainty are inherently stressful. Everything from concern to like just shaking fear. And one thing I would recommend is pick shorter term goals than you might normally otherwise and say, well, this seems like it's likely a good use of the next couple of weeks of our time. And I wish I could provide like longer scale things, but I'm not going to send this team on a 12-week journey somewhere in a period of uncertainty because I don't know what is happening in 12 weeks. Nobody does. But I feel like this is a good use of, I do think that goals are still a good idea and that those goals should unify the team. Like as a team, I would expect that we all know each other's jobs better in 2 weeks. As a team, I would expect that we accomplish this goal of some kind. And so even if you are having to sort of produce that in a vacuum, having a goal that can kind of tie the team together is going to be really useful for that time period. But I wouldn't stretch those out very far because I don't think you can, I think it would be a folly to pretend like you could predict that far out.
Oh, and that plays right into the building the trust of the team. That's one way you can go about building trust in a situation of uncertainty like this. Focus on things that you can help the team execute on and deliver on. Because if you take on that 12-week super lofty, we're going to go write a better React because they had all those technical problems. And if we just did it, well, I know we could do it better. That's a fool's errand. Or any number of iterations of that may be more directly related to your business. I don't know, maybe your business is shipping a JavaScript framework. But if it's not and you have something that you think would work, but it's this moonshot idea, you're going to just blow through all the trust of your team when 3, 4, 6, a week and a half from now, that comes crashing down because the world has shifted in a way that you kind of thought it might, but maybe you didn't have full clarity or didn't know when it was going to happen. And you really thought it was going to be 15, not 5 days, but you've lost that trust. So if you're able to say, you know what, we're going to focus, like the value that we're going to deliver to the objectives that we as a team have agreed upon and that everyone has agreed upon feed into the broader objectives of the company. Here's something that we can bite off right now that in 2 weeks, we know whether or not we did it or not.
Heck, even 2 weeks of bug fixing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't have 2 weeks of bugs, congratulations. You have the best software in the world.
Or you don't have anything. You have something that's not in production yet. One of the two.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. AKA the best software in the world.
The thing that does is it builds some positive momentum and some positive sentiment on the team when whatever wave you think is about to wash over you inevitably comes, the team is better positioned to handle that because they're in a place of feeling productive and feeling like they've accomplished something.
I'll tell you the biggest mistake that I've made in these periods of uncertainty as a manager is not taking care of myself. Because this is a lot. All the stuff we've described, I'm stressed out just talking about it. That's a lot to take on. You said being a sink for people's concerns and fears and worries, trying to provide a vision, trying to provide short-term goals, trying to be a beacon of hope, trying to be equanimous.
One of the key things there, and I think you just skirted over it and like didn't even realize what you said. The key is to be a sink. You're not a barrel for all of the concerns. Like that stuff is going through you. That's the key thing. You got to clear it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It's like a heatsink if you don't have any fans on it. Yeah. You know?
Yep. And I think the three of us are all fortunate in that we have managers ourselves that serve the same role for all of us, where we're able to take some of that to our managers and talk through some of that and process some of those feelings productively.
Maybe less so in Travis as a co-founder. My experience co-founding a That's company true. Was not feeling as supported.
I wasn't going to say manager. Anything, but now that you have.
It's a little different. No, trust me, your co-founder, it's more like having it can be great. It's like having a spouse in some ways, but often it means that you don't have the kind of support that, like I've had both and I'm telling you, having a manager is dope. But yeah, that's a great point. And my manager does remind me, hey, when's the last time you took a vacation? And I'm like, I'm going to send you a mug as soon as we make this.
Yep, I just got told to take a vacation and I'm doing it. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to take a vacation.
I'm so proud of you. Well, I know you have some really epic yard work that sounds amazing. I think that right there is an important point and worth probably ending there, that it is not selfish to look at the challenges of the times that we're facing, of the teams that we're working with, of working through this uncertainty. It's not selfish to look at that and say, I've actually got to take care of myself right now. Like, not just because your team needs you to do that. That is true. Your team does need you to do that. But also, you are a person and you deserve that. You are not a manager bot. We are not work bots. And it can be very easy to only allow yourself to do things because other people need you to. I think that's kind of why a lot of us end up in management, is we really like helping people. But there's an amount of self-care that deserves more than just lip service. And so I'm really glad you're taking a vacation. I haven't had the guts to do so. I took a day off like last week and I was really proud of myself. But I'm actually going to need to do something like that.
What's a day off?
What is day off? What's a vacation, Precious?
Yeah, but I think one thing, so let's fast forward just a little bit here. Let's say you're listening to this. Hey, maybe it's 2 months, maybe it's 2 weeks, but you're listening to this in the future, 2 years from now, whatever that time frame is, and the world is not in as uncertain a place as it is right now that we're recording this. Like everything that we've said is still applicable.
Yeah, you probably still need a vacation right now.
Don't let yourself off the hook.
Statistically.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't let yourself off the hook because like, oh, we're back to business as normal. Like, and I say this as a serial non-vacation taker. And I think all three of us probably qualify pretty epically for that.
Yeah, I've definitely learned that I work better when I sleep. I work better when I take time off. I work better when I'm able to prioritize family time and set boundaries. But the point that I'm also learning is that's not just so that I can work better. That's not my purpose in existence. That's a little broad for this show, but I think it's worth recognizing that every person that we work with, including ourselves, has a life, and that a work is a component of it and can be a rich and rewarding one, but it's not all there is.
Work to live, not live to work.
Yeah, it's so easy to say and so hard to do.
Yep.
But recognizing that to some degree, to whatever degree you can recognize, is probably the most important thing that you can do right now.
Yeah, whenever you are hearing this. I guarantee it's still true.
I mean, I know this is true because I really wish I could go back to myself 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and drill that concept home. And probably 5 years from now, yep. I'll be like, man, really have taken that vacation.
Hang on, I'm going to set something in Evernote to remind you of that.
Well, I feel like that's about as good a place as any to tie this off. For everybody who joined us, thank you so much. We love talking with each other about this stuff. And it was a genuine, we'll pull the curtain back a little bit and say it was a genuine struggle to find something that we've actually gotten together for multiple sessions and couldn't find anything that we could authentically share with people right now that would felt both like personal and relevant and not kind of the same five things that everybody is circulating, which are good things. We really endorse a lot of the manager stuff that's going out around right now about managing in these specific times. But I'm really grateful to both of you two for being my peer mentors during this time. This is where I need it the most. So I'm sad that everybody didn't get to hear the episodes we definitely did not record, but we're so glad to have the ability to share this with you when we do record and when you hear it. Please contact us if you have questions or suggested topics or corrections or any, you know, if you disagree with us strongly or any clarification, you can get at us. We are at Managing Up Show on Twitter. We're also individually on Twitter. I am Tev Viking.
I am N Means.
And I am T. Swicegood.
And as always, our favorite thing is when people give us feedback or when they share this podcast with people, let them know which episodes they've enjoyed. It's really fun to get feedback. We do get it. We do read it. Sometimes we respond to it. We really appreciate it. But mostly we just appreciate you sharing your time with us. And we hope to see you again next time.
Thanks, everybody.
See ya.
Bye.